Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome back to the In-Between Podcast. I'm your host, Mel Barrett. And before we get into today's episode, I want to say this up front. This one is heavy. We're talking about sexual violence, about rape, about two teenage girls who were hurt in the most violent personal way, and about a system that let their attacker walk free. There are details in this story that are brutal. You're going to hear about physical abuse, about strangulation, manipulation, trauma, and how the people in power chose to protect the predator instead of the survivors. If you've been through anything like this, or if someone you love has, please take care of yourself. You do not have to listen to this, or you can pause, come back later, listen with someone at your side. There's no right way to process this. There are support resources in the show notes. You are not alone. All right, deep breath. Let's talk about the injustice of a Stillwater, Oklahoma case about Jesse Mack Butler.
I'm a Stillwater resident, and I'm deeply concerned about a courthouse that lets violent sex offenders walk free out of it, not even with the expectation of being registered.
I'm TJ Ecker with 2 News, following a case in Stillwater that's gained widespread attention on social media. A high school student's pleading no contest to several rape and domestic assault charges.
Jesse Butler was arrested back in March on 10 rape-related charges involving two underage girls. Investigators say the crimes happened over multiple months in 2024 when Butler was around 17 years old.
And he was sentenced to nearly 80 years behind bars. But now this Oklahoma teenage baseball prodigy is avoiding prison altogether. And his victims' loved ones say the justice system failed them.
If you were with me during the Veronica Rodriguez case coverage, you already know I do not believe silence is an option. Not when victims are silenced by the very system that's supposed to protect them. Not when survivors have to walk past their attackers in high school hallways. Not when the state decides their trauma just doesn't matter enough. So today, we're going to take you through everything there is to know about the Jesse Butler case. The timeline, the police, the charges, the judge, the plea deal, his family's role, the protests, and why this matters, not just for Stillwater, but for every survivor who's ever been told, directly or indirectly, that what happened to them isn't a big deal. So let's go back to September 2024. Two 16-year-old girls at Stillwater High School walk into a school resource officer's office with written statements in their hands. Those statements say that Jesse Mack Butler, a popular baseball player at the school, raped and assaulted them multiple times. In one case, he allegedly choked a girl until she passed out, until she thought she was going to die. The Stillwater Police Department launched a formal investigation almost immediately. Detectives conducted interviews with both girls separately and noted striking similarities in their accounts. Details about Jesse Butler's language, behaviors, the location of the assaults, and the way he used physical force. Both girls agreed to undergo sexual assault nurse examiner or SANE exams. The medical evidence supported their claims, bruising consistent with strangulation, internal injuries, signs of trauma that matched their statements. On top of that, both victims had confided in friends and family before coming forward. Those witnesses corroborated the timeline. Text messages and photos were preserved. There were signs, emotional and physical, that made it clear these girls weren't fabricating anything. One victim secured a protective order, which Butler violated multiple times, approaching her on campus, attempting to initiate conversations, reportedly trying to intimidate her. Police added these violations to the growing case file. When all was said and done, prosecutors charged Jesse Mack Butler with 11 felonies. First-degree rape, rape with instrumentation, attempted first-degree rape, sexual battery, domestic assault and battery by strangulation, two counts of violating a protective order. If he were tried and convicted as an adult, he could have faced up to 78 years in prison. It was one of the most serious criminal filings against a Stillwater teen in recent memory. And based on the evidence and witness cooperation, many believe the case was airtight. But here's where the story turns. On March 4th, 2025, Jesse Butler is quietly arrested. Here's the body cam audio of that arrest. The woman speaking to cops is Jesse's mother.
We're ready to obviously tell our story too.
Yeah.
Jess, it's mom. Open the door. It's me.
And if you'll just have him step out.
Okay. Give me your wallet and phone and stuff. So,
okay.
Your what?
They're in the car.
Well, okay, it's fine. It's not locked or anything, is it? Okay. So, can you tell him what you just told me?
So we're here. We're obviously going to place you under arrest. There's a warrant for your arrest. We're going to take you to the jail. I told your mom that she can contact a bondsman. And you shouldn't be very long, but there just is a process for paperwork and stuff. But right now, you do have to come with us, and I do have to put you in handcuffs. So turn around for me.
You have to put him in handcuffs? I
do. Why? If I have to transport somebody into community custody.
You know we're going to win this. It's okay.
Yeah.
A little happy.
Yeah.
I'll get you out. For me? All right. Stay silent. Rick knows about this. Candy's on this. Dad's on his way. We're coming to get you, okay? Just stay strong, okay? Say your prayers. Awful experience for a child.
In case you didn't hear the last bit at the end, Jesse's mother says, awful experience for a child, meaning her child. Jesse is released the same day. No bail bond, no detainment, just a brief court appearance and back to his life. Then in July, Judge Susan Worthington grants him youthful offender status, a designation that transfers his case out of the adult criminal system and into a rehabilitative track meant for teens who show quote unquote potential for reform. What was Jesse's potential for reform? This is a kid who raped and nearly killed girls in his class. Was it that he was a star baseball player, or was it that he was a young white man with potential? Was his potential for reform embedded in the affluence of his family? In August, Butler enters a no-contest plea to every charge. He doesn't admit guilt, but he doesn't deny the acts either. And the sentence Worthington hands down? Not one day of incarceration. Jesse Mack Butler received 150 hours of community service, enrollment in sex offender treatment and counseling, a nightly curfew, a ban from social media platforms, and oversight by the Office of Juvenile Affairs until he turns 19. No prison, no juvenile detention, no jail. For two girls who survived months of abuse and came forward in extraordinary detail and courage, that was the court's answer. Community service and therapy for a boy who nearly choked one of them to death. This isn't some gray area story. This isn't a misunderstanding or teenage drama gone wrong. What Jesse Butler did was methodical, violent, and repeated. It was calculated harm, and he targeted girls who trusted him, who were isolated by his charm and social standing. This wasn't just about physical control. It was about domination, erasure, taking away someone's ability to function, to feel human, to exist without fear. In the details provided to law enforcement, one of the survivors described Jesse's routine. How he would isolate her emotionally, gaslight her into thinking the abuse was her fault, and escalate physical violence when she pushed back. He would use his popularity to shield himself. After choking her unconscious during one of the assaults, she said he barely reacted when she came to. No remorse, no panic, just silence, as if it was normal, as if her near-death experience meant nothing to him. The second survivor described Jesse pinning her down, ignoring her pleas, forcing himself on her while she froze in fear. Afterwards, she said he would act like nothing had happened, send cheerful texts, try to hang out with her again, creating a cycle of emotional confusion and psychological abuse. These weren't one-off moments of aggression. They are a pattern. Jesse would manipulate boundaries, use guilt, love bomb, then threaten, touch without consent in school hallways, demand secrecy. The power imbalance was obvious. He was an admired athlete, a student from a high-profile family, and these girls were alone in this. Afraid they wouldn't be believed, afraid of retaliation. And despite all that fear, they still came forward. The attacks happened over months, at school, at parties, in cars, behind closed doors, and in each case, Jesse pushed a little further. According to one of the police interviews, he told one victim no one would care if she spoke up, that she would be blamed, that he would be fine and she would be the one humiliated. And in some cruel, twisted way, he was absolutely right. Because the system didn't stop him. It didn't protect those girls. It rewarded Jesse with a second chance. It gave him therapy instead of a cell. It gave him community service instead of accountability. This wasn't just about what Jesse Butler did to young girls. It's about what he was allowed to do and get away with because of who he is, because of who his father is, because of the jersey he wore. Because when push came to shove, the institutions around him chose to protect the predator instead of the people he preyed on. Let's talk about accountability, about the institutions and individuals who could have stopped this, or at the very least delivered justice, and instead chose to look the other way. Who let this happen? Let's name some names. Let's start with Judge Susan C. Worthington, a special district judge appointed to preside over this case. Worthington isn't just any judge. She's a figure deeply tied to the Stillwater community, a name with connections, a courtroom presence with close ties to Oklahoma State University, the very institution where Jesse Butler's father once served as the director of football operations. These aren't distant associations. These are the kind of links that make you wonder, was this impartial justice or small-town cronyism at work? Then there's the prosecutor, Laura Austin Thomas, the Payne County District Attorney. She's a veteran in her field, a Republican, a woman who's built her reputation on being tough on crime. She's been reelected multiple times on promises of accountability and justice, and yet she helped negotiate the plea deal that let Jesse Butler walk, a deal that erased 11 felony charges, that silenced the girl's suffering with the legal equivalent of a slap on the wrist. What happened to tough on crime? Or does that only apply when the defendant isn't white or well-connected or the son of someone with influence? Because let's not ignore the optics here. Jesse Butler isn't just any kid. He's a white, upper-middle-class teenager from a family with status in the community. His dad was a prominent figure at OSU Athletics. His family is well-known, well-liked. He was a varsity athlete, a future college baseball player, someone with potential. In towns like Stillwater, college towns with long-standing relationships between public institutions and private families, this kind of influence matters. It means closed-door conversations, unspoken alliances, quiet protections. And in this case, it meant a complete institutional failure to center the victims. So let's ask some hard questions. Would a Black teenager accused of rape, battery, and strangulation have been given youthful offender status? Would a Latino kid from a working-class family have been offered therapy over incarceration? Would your son or your daughter's attacker get this deal? Or does justice in Stillwater only extend to those with the right name, the right sport, and the right skin color? Because make no mistake, the justice system made a decision here. It decided that Jesse Butler's future mattered more than the safety, dignity, and humanity of the girls he hurt. And it did so with full knowledge of the facts, with the evidence laid bare, with witness statements and forensic proof. This wasn't a loophole. This was a choice. And a judge, a woman with supreme power, made that choice. This choice tells victims everywhere, don't bother coming forward, because even when we believe you, even when we have proof, even when the law is on your side, if your rapist is the wrong kind of kid to punish, we'll protect him instead of you. Let's break down the legal mechanism that made it all possible. The Oklahoma Youthful Offender Act. Enacted in 1994, the Youthful Offender Act was designed as a middle path for teenagers between the ages of 15 and 17 who commit serious crimes. The idea was not that all teens are beyond redemption. Some may be held accountable in a way that focuses on rehabilitation without the life-crippling effects of adult prison. It was meant to address kids who made terrible but impulsive choices, theft, carjacking, drug offenses, in some cases even assault. But what the act never intended to do was provide a get-out-of-jail-free card for serial predators. Under the statute, a judge has discretion. They can certify a minor as a youthful offender, which allows them to avoid adult sentencing and instead be placed under the jurisdiction of the Office of Juvenile Affairs, or the OJA. But that doesn't mean the teen automatically walks free. Judges can still impose confinement in a juvenile facility. They can order more restrictive forms of supervision. They can, and often do, require treatment in secure environments, especially for violent offenses. In Jesse Butler's case, however, the court used the youthful offender designation not as a rehabilitative bridge, but as a shield, a way to sidestep adult prison, juvenile lockup, or any meaningful consequence altogether. The court had options. It could have committed Butler to a juvenile justice facility until his 19th birthday. It could have imposed tighter surveillance or placed him in a structured treatment center with accountability protocols. Instead, Judge Susan Worthington chose the softest possible version of this law. Let's review what that actually looks like. 150 hours of community service with no specifics provided, required enrollment in counseling and sex offender treatment, unverified in public records, a curfew not publicly detailed or enforced through detention, a social media ban difficult to monitor and rarely enforced unless violated openly, regular check-ins with a case manager until his 19th birthday. There was no placement in a secure youth facility. There was no sex offender registry requirement. There was no jail, not even a weekend behind bars. And by using the Youthful Offender Act this way, the court essentially told the victims and every future victim watching, if your rapist is young and well-connected, the system will bend to protect them. What's even more frustrating is that other cases involving much lesser offenses have received harsher sentences under the same law. There are teens in Oklahoma juvenile centers right now for burglary, for possession of marijuana, for joyriding, teens who made stupid decisions but didn't harm another human being, teens who were locked up without the benefit of therapy or community service or a chance to finish high school on their own terms. And yet here was Jesse Butler, accused of rape, attempted rape, strangulation, and repeated protective order violations, walking away from it all with what amounts to a checklist. The Youthful Offender Act was written with discretion for a reason. But in this case, discretion became distortion. The law didn't fail. The people who have the power to wield it did. If you listen to my coverage of the Veronica Rodriguez case, you know how much this hurts, how deep the rot goes. Veronica was failed by a system that didn't believe her either. Here, the system believed the victims. There was evidence, there were charges, and still it said, meh, he's just a kid. I'm sick of this pattern of prosecutors hiding behind policies, of judges allegedly doing favors for insiders, of a system that bends over backwards for the accused and spits on the people they harmed. And thank God the community showed up. On November 5th, over 100 people protested at the courthouse. Students, parents, survivors. They held signs that read, "Stillwater deserves better." They called for Judge Worthington and D.A. Thomas to resign.
No justice, no peace.
We're done. We're done not saying anything. We're done allowing rapists to walk free. We're done seeing the people in charge allowing this to happen.
Susan Worthington's got to go! No justice!
No peace!
As a, a victim myself, I believe that women have the right to, to stand up for themselves and justice to be served, honestly. And none of these girls are getting the justice that they deserved.
The DA and the assistant DA have such a history of either not filing charges against survivors or just allowing the rapists to walk free. I know that because I filed my case here when I was 17 and she wouldn't even file my charges. And I see that it's become a pattern and enough is enough. And it's time for us to come together and say something.
No peace! No justice! No peace!
And let's be clear. They're right to be angry. Because this wasn't justice. It was a cover-up with a smile. A slap on the wrist from people who should know better. So where do we go from here? The next court review for Jesse Butler is scheduled for December 8th. If he behaves, he walks away with no record. No jail, no sex offender status, nothing. And an open door to do exactly what he's been doing, again, to another woman. That can't be okay. There needs to be oversight. There needs to be reform. There needs to be accountability for every person who thought this deal was acceptable. And I want you to ask yourself, what would you have done if this happened to your child, to your sister, to your friend? This isn't a Stillwater story. This is about every community that protects predators, every courthouse that confuses a rehabilitation with absolution, every kid who's ever been told, it's not worth reporting, nothing will happen. I want to tell you, keep reporting, keep speaking up, keep fighting, and be good people and take no for an answer. The In Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. Special thanks to my mentors, Amber Hunt, Ellen Marsh, and Rebecca Lavoie, for their super smart guidance and support. If you want ad-free exclusive content, bonuses, and lives, head on over to the In Between podcast Patreon and sign up. The intern level starts at just $4, and there's already 75-plus ad-free episodes for you to binge right now. You can watch my new show, Something's Off with Rebecca Lavoie, over on YouTube at Something's Off Pod or listen on Patreon. Episodes drop weekly on Fridays. Stay tuned after this episode for the trailer of Something's Off. Follow the In Between podcast on Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube at In Between Pod, and on Instagram at The In Between Pod Official. On TikTok, you can follow me at Jack of All Trades DC. Thanks for listening. You know, we dig into stories that don't sit right, the cases where justice feels incomplete. Well, I've got something new for you. Rebecca Lavoie from Crime Writers On and I are teaming up for a brand new show called Something's Off. Every week, we'll take on the cases that make you stop and say, wait, what? From current cases like the murder of Sandra Birchmore to the trial of Karen Reed to the Long Island serial killer and all the way back to the Menendez brothers, when the story doesn't add up, that's where we dig in.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
And I'm Mel Barrett, and this is Something's Off.
He still pressed her, and when he did, she was just like, come on. Like, that was her. It was just like, no, that's ridiculous.
It was exactly how one should respond when being challenged with something that either isn't true or is a distortion of the truth.
How much longer can this go on?
He said, how do you know there wasn't something under where his head landed? And she said, because I saw the photos.
She's not even telling the jury that he made a mistake.
So can we talk about this kind of like bombshelly thing that happened today?
Yeah, you want to talk about the x-rays?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a new tell today.
Where
and
he would
it's
repeat
hilarious.
Back the answer that they just said?
So the tell that I saw, he would ask her a yes or no question. Like he wanted a yes and she would go, no. And he would go, oh. He would just go, oh, you know, mathematical equations. How about the fact that he said there were no x-rays?
Correct.
He, too, is a liar.
I mean, either he was lying or Hank Brennan was lying. And Alan Jackson definitely intimated Hank Brennan has been lying to you. He said to her,
do you agree that a brain is very soft, consistent with, for example, tofu?
Oh, gross. No.
And then Bev said, I'll strike that. No comments.
Yeah.
Watch Something's Off with Mel Barrett and Rebecca Lavoie on YouTube and exclusively on Patreon starting mid-October. I'll leave you a link in the show notes.